Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our second Hall of Fame podcast of 2016 for the 2017 Hall of Fame. And today, as you will already know, we're going to be focusing on sports cars, and we have the 2016 winner and Hall of Fame inductee with us, Derek Bell. Thank you so much for having us down to your this lovely spot of England that seems to be the only sunny spot in England, full stop, today.
Yes, it's probably raining before you leave, but anyway, I'm glad you're here. Yeah, we have the little microclimate, and it is quite amazing. When that guy arrived just now, he said, yeah, you just have this climate right here, and he drove off back up to Staines, you know, knowing that, and obviously he's used to coming into this microclimate in his truck.
So today, our main task today is to come up with a set of 12 names for the public to vote on in the sports car category for next year's Hall of Fame. So we'll come on to that in a bit, and there are some rules and regulations which I think we sort of understand.
Just about.
So we'll come on to that in a bit. What I wanted to do is take some readers' questions, because we've had loads of readers' questions, ranging from how you get your hair to look so cool to various more motorsports-related topics. I will probably go with the latter today. First of all, who knew that not only were you a racing driver, but also a barista? We've all been having your delicious coffee this morning. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to come straight in with a reader's question from John Bishop, actually, which is talking about your old teammates. And
how much time have we got?
There's
so many of them, thank goodness.
But he wants to know which one made the biggest impact on you during your career.
It's really, really difficult, but I would have to say Jackie Hicks, simply because he was really the first sports. I mean, Joe Siffert was there in the beginning and Pedro, but bless them, they weren't around long. But Jackie was sort of part of my first Le Mans win. And then thereafter, he was part of my second Le Mans win and my third Le Mans win. And so, therefore, there has to be, he did have an impact. And I think he had a tremendous impact on my sort of mentality about racing. I mean, I wasn't a wild, stupid guy, but I think having him around me, people respected him so much within the teams. I mean, wherever we walked, it was Jackie Hicks, Jackie Hicks. And I knew with Jackie that I was going to get a bloody good car. It seemed that if I wasn't with Jackie, and Gary might remember some of this, I sort of would go, it ain't going to work because I'm not with Jackie. And it often didn't work. I didn't really do that well if I wasn't with him. Now you're going to say, well, because he was so much better than you. But I think in the end, or during that period, I became equally as good as him over an hour or even quickest lap times. And, you know, I beat him quite well on a few occasions over the years. So I think he brought me up to his level, in a mental level and also a driving capability level. And also, I didn't crash it because he never really crashed. And I, therefore, I went through most of my career without crashing either. So he had a great sort of impact on me, I thought.
Had an amazing aura, or he has got an amazing aura about him. Did he have that at the time?
It was a totally different aura. It was very, I would have to say, and I'm sure he's not listening, but he had quite a selfish aura. He was introverted aura. He didn't talk to many people unless he had to. He didn't suffer fools. Well, there's nothing wrong in that. So I was miracle he ever got on with me, really. Excuse me. But the thing was, he came from, I think, a fairly, I would say, a modestly wealthy family, lawyers, his father and his brother. And of course, he started, if you're doing, you know, trials and stuff when you're 16, somebody paid for it. So, you know, I didn't sit in a car till I was 23. And I think in his case, somebody helped him on the way. Don't get me wrong, might well have been him, but I don't think he was earning money at 16 or whatever age it was. And so consequently, he sort of came from a different background to me, I think. Now, I've never really inquired about that. Mm-hmm. But when you start that young, you know that they had to have some help.
Yes.
And he, you know, he was very good. He was European champion, I think, in some trials and that sort of thing. And then, of course, it was immediately signed, you know, went to Ken Tyrrell. And he went, I mean, fancy going straight to Ken Tyrrell. That's not a bad thing to go where Jackie Stewart's been or was at the time. So he obviously was terribly talented. Mm-hmm. But he went, and you know, I wouldn't say the money helped at all then. It was purely his talent. And wherever but he always had this air of, I would say, perhaps a little bit superior. Mm-hmm. And I know lots of drivers, my dear old Mike Hailward and various people didn't like him because they felt he was maybe a little arrogant. Uh-huh. But Jackie only did what was really good for Jackie. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like being a team member of his, or because what was good for Jackie was again good for Derek. Excuse me. So consequently, he just had this air about him, this aura about him. And I mean, I then met him at Ferrari, you see. And he was in Formula One when I joined Ferrari in 68, and I was in Formula Two. Then my first Grand Prix was with him against him at mm-hmm. Monza. And Chris was on Eamon on the front row, and Jackie the second row, me on the third row. And I was really cheesed off because I wasn't quicker. I mean, I was mm-hmm. on the third row of a Grand Prix grid. I should have been quite happy, really, but I guess if you're a Grand Prix driver, a young up-and-coming of 25 is a young, then, you know, perhaps, you know, I should have been the way I was, but I was disappointed I wasn't quicker. Mm-hmm. And so therefore I was with Jackie quite early on, and he had an impression, as did Chris, of course.
Well, John also says that he'd loved meeting you on occasion at the Daytona 24 Hours, and you always took time for a chat and an autograph. So, well done you. It's paid off.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. That was very kind of you. The reason being is that nobody knew who the hell I was, and they're all gathering around Jackie E.
there's another question here, which I wonder whether we might have answered with that previous question, and this is from someone called Flying Kiwi. I don't think that's his real name. If so, he's got some bold parents. So if you had to step out of the driver's seat and into the passenger seat, who would you have driving you, which car and which circuit?
I'm not at all keen on any of that.
I did wonder. Typical racing driver.
My mind runs back to Spa, you know, on the old track, and if I went as a passenger with anybody, not too keen. I have to say that it did actually happen. And I went. I was trying to learn the Nürburgring with my dear old 3.8 E-type Jaguar, because I, you know, never been to the ring back in 68, beginning of 68. And I thought I should learn it in something rather insignificant, you know, in the race-wise. So I was going to drive a Chevron B16. And anyway, so I was going around in the E-type. And I did about 5 laps and had no brakes left, and it was all overheating. And I wasn't going that quickly, and I still didn't know where the hell I was. And so one of the French drivers, Patrick Depailler, came up to me, who really only knew me through Formula 3. And he said to me, "Hey, Derek, why don't I take you around? I've done a couple of 84-hour races here. And I suppose if it's going around any track, Nürburgring is probably the one that, you know, you're going to suffer the most."
Was that really Depailler?
Yes.
You think? Oh, right,
yes.
Okay.
Well, do you think I was bloody lying again?
No, I just thought...
You've been around motor racing too long. You don't believe anybody, do you?
Different eras, I was thinking.
No, it wasn't. There was only about a year, you know. That's a year, not an era.
It's just years
spelt the other way around.
Right.
Anyway, I love Gary. Okay, he only appears when you don't want him. Anyway, and so he said, "Come on, jump in my little Renault Alpine." Mm-hmm. And, of course, he had done, you know, those little things are about 2'6" high, total height. And he wasn't terribly tall. So I squeezed myself in and off we went round the ring. And I have to say, I did learn it remarkably quickly. And then...
So is that because you were so desperate not to do another lap with him that you had to learn it quickly?
No, well, actually, yes. Funny enough, if somebody takes you around Silverstone fast, it's pretty frightening. But to be taken round the Nürburgring, it's absolutely educational and amazing. And the thing about the ring is... that once you realise that the bloke isn't about to crash, he's not really trying to overshow himself, that, you know, you're very happy to sit there because you're taking it in. Around Silverstone, you know what I know what the limits are, and if I see this bloke coming in, everything locked up, facing the wrong way, I know we're in a spot of bother.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, honestly, Patrick was probably the best example of anybody learning a track.
Was he smoking whilst driving?
No, he had both hands on the wheel, believe me, and he didn't have it turned the other way in his mouth when he went round a corner.
We mentioned this earlier, before we went on air, as it were. This is from Doug Greenwood, and he's wondering whether you would rather one more lap at Le Mans in 83 to try and catch Hulbert, or one more lap of fuel in 88 when Ludwig ran dry.
Well, in reality, the second, but the first one, if I had another one lap, we would have won it because they weren't going to go another lap.
Their engine
so
was
we
gone.
Were due to win. So another couple of hundred yards would have done, actually. Mm-hmm. But I think the race in 88, did we say?
Yes.
The 88 race. Yeah. I call it the Ludwig race. I can't think why. that we could have done just with another lap in that. Because I thought when you deserve to win, well, I think we deserve to win in 83 too, but I think when you deserve to win, like the way we'd, you know, driven so hard and led the race, only to find that one of our teammates tried to do an extra lap to prove he was a better German than the others, a bit tough. But I still really get on well with Klaus, and he really knows that he screwed up.
Really,
and I remember during the race, they said, "Hey, Ludwig gets in again," and we said, "Stuck in." I say, "He ain't getting in again. No, we leave him out until we were both very upset.
Blimey. We've got a lot of questions here from someone called Racing Red, and they're all, and the title of them is Memories from Maranello. So I'm no guessing man, but I would say he's a Ferrari fan.
I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah. So what you would love to know is actually what it was like to get the call from Maranello and what it was like meeting Enzo for the first time, because it must have been quite a surreal experience, I would have thought.
I've written a very good book, I think.
Is it available at all good
bookstores? It is still available, They certainly have run out. And get out there, because Redmond's isn't nearly as good as mine. No, actually, Brian's book is fantastic, and John Fitzpatrick's coming out any day now as well.
So. I think it's out, actually.
Yeah, it's out.
It's reviewed in this month's Motorsport magazine. Yeah,
it is. I should have known that.
It is actually, you should actually. But no, it is. Both of them are good books. But sorry, Maranello. How did it come about? Well, can you imagine? I just got up into Formula 2, and I'd done a couple of races, and the tragedy of Jimmy Clark dying in my second race, which was at Hockenheim, and he was my hero, utterly, as far as you know, the longevity and what he had done, and who he was, and what an amazing person, and there he was. You know, not surviving Hockenheim. And after that, I didn't know really whether I was going to carry on racing in so many ways. But it's funny, for some reason, you just carry on because that's all you set your mind at doing was becoming a racing driver. And I got a call. I think the first call came from actually from Keith Ballistat at Shell, to be honest, is how it happened. And of course, Shell sponsored Ferrari. And so Keith contacted me from London and said, you know, Ferrari would like you to go. And they're bringing a car over for Crystal Palace in 2 weeks' time, 3 weeks' time. And after the race, they'd like you to do a test at Goodwood. Excuse me. Well, as you can imagine, I was pretty damn excited because I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I'd ever get a request from Ferrari. So I said, yes, that'd be wonderful. So I was racing at Crystal Palace in my Formula 2 car, Formula 2 Brabham from Church Farm Racing. And this was March, April 68. It had to be after end of April because Jimmy died in April. And so it was April, beginning of May. And so we went to Crystal Palace and with Jackie Ickx in the car, and I was in my Brabham. And of course, Jackie had a crash. So the car was wrecked. And I thought, well, that's my luck, you know, Derek Bell's, because you seem to go with luck in those days, up and down. So although I said, I'll never get there. So that was it. We're not testing now. Thanks, Mr. Bell. You know, anyway, two weeks later, I got a call. Would you come to Monza and test there? So I went to Monza and tested there. There were about 12, 14 of us, but I think most of them were Italians. Enzo, for some reason, wasn't too keen on Italians, which is very unfair, apart from he couldn't afford the repair bills all the time. So anyway, I somehow must have impressed. I don't know what the lap times were. Mm-hmm. I knew the track, obviously. We'd all raced Formula 3 and Formula 2 there. And I got the call, and so they said, okay, Señor Bell, you come down to Maranello. So I went down to Maranello that night in my Fiat 124, and stayed at the Cavallino, not the Cavallino, the Santa, what the heck's it called? The Real Fini Hotel. Stayed there the night, and it was, there's lots of stories involved with that. It doesn't affect my driving ability, but it was quite funny getting to know the local culture rather quickly. And so the next day went out to the factory, and I was picked up and taken out there. And of course, you know, I walked around the factory. There was nobody working. I was there with one of the secretaries, a male secretary, walking around, nobody working. And he said, I looked and he could say, well, there's no people anyway, not even the race shop. He said, it's a national holiday today. I thought, that's unusual on a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So, but I learned over my next 2 years that in fact, national holiday meant they're on strike.
Oh, really? Right.
And a shop at all. It's one of the few tiny words I can still remember off the top of my head.
I didn't want to say that.
There were so many of them.
I didn't realize you were so educated, actually.
Well,
so
I'm definitely not.
So that was it. So then, anyway, I was walking around the factory, seeing everything. It was astonishing, long story, obviously. And then, sort of around the corner, came this gentleman with a smaller chap beside him, the gentleman who was. His sort of white raincoat over his shoulders and his tinted glasses and that incredibly smooth hair. And this chap with me, he said, oh, here comes old Commendatore now. Here's the one on the left, as if there was any doubt which one was Enzo. And we talked, and it was most amazing. It was a sight which nobody's ever had. And as I often say, you know, poor old Michael Schumacher, he might have made millions and everything, but he never saw Enzo Ferrari. And I saw him literally walking down between the cars, reds and yellows, up on the assembly line, walking towards me. Mm. The picture that would be in the front of a magazine, it was absolutely incredible. Really. And that was my first impression of Enzo. So then we went to the Cavallino and had lunch. And he mainly wanted to talk about Jochen Rindt. He obviously had a buzz, well, he should do, because he and I in Formula 2, and Jochen and I were finishing first and second quite a lot in those early races. And so, he was just very interested in the whole thing and what I thought my future was. But he was really caught up in Jochen Rindt. Mm. I thought, what the hell has he brought me here for? he could have phoned me for that. And so that was it, really. And that was then they said, but at the same time, I'd had a call from Cooper's to drive Cooper Formula One. I went actually to I went to Silverstone to test the little B16 again, the one that I never got around to at the Nürburgring. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, Colin Chapman's there, and he's there with the STP Lotus turbine, and Graham's going around, and he looks up to me up on the balcony, and he goes, "You're going well this year." And I look around thinking, "Who the hell is he talking about?" I went, "Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chapman." Yeah. I thought, you know, God has spoken. So 5 minutes later, he says, "Come down here." So I went down. And he said, "You drive an automatic." And he sent me out in his Jag to do 5 minutes running. I said, "I can drive an automatic now. I can drive anything with 800 horsepower."
Wouldn't have been a great advert for you if you said, "Actually, I'm totally out of out of my depth with an automatic." Right.
800 horsepower. I'd never driven anything more than 200 at this point. And there I am getting a bloody 800 horsepower turbine around Silverstone. So anyway, I was literally sitting in the car in my overalls, ready to go out to test. And they said, "We can't let you out because we can't hear where Graham is because they don't make a noise." And you could hear was the pads hitting the discs. So and then I sat there for 10 minutes thinking, "My goodness me, this is all in my bit with Ferrari."
Yeah.
And I'm going, "Oh my goodness." And anyway, next thing is they can't say, "Sorry, Graham's car's transmission's broken. He's going to take this." So I got out and that was it.
So you were sat in it, helmet on, ready to go.
Absolutely. I have a photograph somewhere, but I haven't come across it. But I know there is one because I remember seeing it. It looked bloody boring, me sitting there, just sitting in the paddock with my helmet on, looking, crumbs, what am I going to go and do now? And so that was that. And at the same time, of course, I then went straight almost to the test at Monza. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I had to come back to Silverstone to test for Cooper. They wanted me to drive that big Cooper Maserati.
Oh, right, okay.
And eventually, I went backwards and forwards two or three times. Ferrari were offering me Formula 2 with a view to Formula 1. Mm-hmm. And of course, Cooper offered me Formula 1. And this is the car you'll have next year, Mr. Bell. And I'm going, "Well, you mean it's take that long to build it?" Mm-hmm. You know, and then we talked about a contract, and I thought I'd pick up, you know, maybe £50,000 or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, surely they'd pay you something. All these Formula One drivers got money. And we actually got down to the fact of a nominal fee of £5.
Is that right?
Yes, that's my offer from Cooper's. So That was it.
Nothing's changed.
No. So now and then. So that was it anyway. Apologies, but it wasn't John Cooper that said that. It was his sidekick. So that was the end of that. So I actually decided Ferrari had to be, or always needed to be Ferrari. So I went to Ferrari. Oh. But again, it's a long, long story, but I won't go on. We've got no time left for that.
No. Well, there's a sort of follow-up question from Racing Red. He wants to know the good and bad points of racing for Ferrari. And I think we've covered some of the good points, certainly, in terms of, you know, this it's the most famous team in the world, isn't it? It wasn't the easiest of teams to race for, I think, because of politics and various other bits and pieces.
Yeah, I think, as far as I was concerned, I was very obviously number three in the team. And Enzo was trying me. I don't know whether he knew Jackie Ickx was leaving. I'm sure he didn't in June. I don't know what he had in mind, because he was bringing in the new flat 12 the following year. And of course, being a bit of an ignorant idiot, I didn't know what was happening next year. Mm-hmm. But I know he was just trying to find out how well I went, just generally speaking, with a view to the future. So to be honest, I didn't know what was going to happen, what I was being offered for the future at all. So there were no promises. And as I say, they'd phone up and say, El Comandatore, we'll have dinner with you tonight. He'll pick you up at 6:30 and we'd jump. He'd come around in his brace, you know, wearing his, the braces, braces we call them. And, you know, the door would be opened and then I'd leap in the car and off we'd go for dinner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an astonishing experience for me, and nothing in the whole of the time that I was at Ferrari could I say I was disappointed in him, because it wasn't his fault. Mm-hmm. The fact was, we were there at the wrong time, and even Mauro Fogheri, 3 or 4 years ago when we met, he said, it's such a pity you came at the wrong time, because obviously I wasn't slow, because I was leading the European Championship in Formula 2, and I went on to drive quite well for Surtees, the one in the US Grand Prix. So I knew I wasn't a world champion. I've never felt that, but I was certainly, a good second string driver, mm-hmm. and might have been better for all I know.
Just talking about Enzo, did he speak in English did he speak through a translator?
No. Just he and I. No, he spoke French, so I had to speak French.
Oh, I see.
And okay. Everybody said he spoke English, but he just wouldn't do it because he didn't want to make it easy for me and difficult for him. So we struggled away in French.
How good was your French back in those days?
Not very good, but he did get better very quickly.
Well, I'm glad this podcast is all in English today, otherwise I would be very lost. Back to sports cars. Jack from Norfolk is wondering how the Bob Tullius Jaguar test came about and whether Porsche was aware of the test.
Yes, well, you didn't explain it very well there, Ed.
Sorry. Blame that on Jack, actually, because I just read out his question.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Of course you did. That's not me. Yeah. I know. You came a long way to ask me these questions. You should get them right. But anyway... the Tullius car was raced in America, slightly different rules and regulations. And I was racing there in the 962s, so in the Löhnbräu Porsche. And we were doing well, Holbert and I were, winning most of the races, I have to say. The Tullius car was always around, but I would say only probably beat us once. But it wasn't a bad car, and it was very sweet, and it was the V12, I think I'm right in saying, normally aspirated, so therefore quite an easy car to drive in many ways. And they decided that with X and I were driving the 962, I think it was Jackie still, driving the 962 at Silverstone and the 1,000 kilometres. And we won the race on the Sunday. But prior to that, I had a call from Jaguar from Jim Randall, that's right. And he phoned me and said, would there be a possibility we're bringing the car over to evaluate it? Would you be prepared to drive it? So I asked Porsche, and he said, fine. I mean, what the only benefit would be to Porsche if a new manufacturer came in.
Yeah,
that's right. So I went. So I stayed on after the 1,000 Ks, and the next morning went and drove the car. And actually, it went extremely well. I mean, it was actually on ITN News that night. I mean, it was quite a big deal. Jaguar was coming back to racing in Britain, Le Mans, all that sort of thing. And I did quite a lot of laps. We didn't change the car much, and I can't remember exactly who was there to run it, but obviously were one or two of Tullius guys. And I never knew the purpose of it. I didn't know the Walkinshaw thing was around the corner. And but it just wasn't as good as the 962. It just, remember, in America, we weren't allowed as much ground effect, and the cars ran a bit higher. So therefore, all in all, it certainly didn't have the grip around the corners that we had. It wasn't, that I recollect, that much slower. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember we'd been doing a lot of laps over the weekend. And I think I gave it a fair run, but I was still, I would say, a second and a half to 2 seconds slower, which you might say, blimey, anybody could pick that up. They probably could if they'd lowered it. But I don't know what their ultimate plan was. Obviously, I would suggest Walkinshaw, nobody from his team were there, and I knew nothing about that they were headed that way.
Right, I'm going to be very precise with my questions from now on, Derek. Pulled up on them. This one's from Jamie Smith, and there's always interest around Steve McQueen, but he wants to know what he was really like. Obviously, you got to know him well on the set of Le Mans, how you rated his driving skills, because there's two camps out there. There's one camp who thinks that he was totally overrated.
The Mario Andretti camp.
The Mario Andretti camp, let's call it. And then there's another camp who think that he was actually really very good behind the wheel. What are your memories of him and his driving skills?
You've got to realise that when you're on a film, a movie as they call it, you always drive a little bit under the maximum because you're not actually lapping the whole track. So you've got to get going very quickly, go through. I mean, we're using a third or a quarter of the track at a time, and we weren't hanging about. And also, you get very bored if you don't go fast. You really want to drive. I mean, and I insisted after, you know, having seen the Grand Prix film where everything was sort of Formula Fords with, or should I say, looking like Grand Prix cars in a Formula Ford, Formula 3 chassis, Formula Junior chassis. I always felt that you can't just make cars look faster. We had to drive at the speeds. Mm-hmm. And they were the real speed. So certainly we drove. But remember, I mean, it was basically, I'd only done two sports car races. We'd done Spa and Le Mans, and there I was driving in the Le Mans movie. So I wasn't the best one to judge anybody. But all I will tell you, I was driving with Joe Siffert a lot on the film, more than anybody else. And Joe was in the 917. Steve was in a 917. And I was in a 512 Ferrari, mm-hmm. as I had raced. And so consequently, my answer to that is that Steve, to me, was very, very good. Whether he would have made a great racing driver, I have no idea. But then at 45, he ain't going to start becoming a great racing driver. Give him a break, you know. All the other Mario camp, if you're talking about, which I'd never heard all that. But, I mean, they started when they were in diapers. Mm. And so they had to become good. It's very difficult to become that good at 45.
McQueen drove your Brabham, didn't he?
Yes.
You took it. On the way somewhere, you took it.
At Le Mans.
Yeah.
Yeah, he drove it on Bugatti. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yes, he did. And only because I knew he was good enough to drive it. And, I mean, he didn't spin it or anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think I ever saw him spin.
Oh, really?
Now, that's bloody good in a 917. Mm-hmm. And then to drive my little F2 round, he very gingerly went round five laps. Remember, he'd never sat in a single seater, to my knowledge. He was very sensible. Mm-hmm. And considering his sort of wild exterior, the character he appeared to have with bikes in and driving in Bullet and that sort of thing. But he had his head screwed on correctly. And I thought he was very good. I didn't have a problem with him, you know, getting in amongst us. And I mean, that one occasion when I was in front and he was behind me, in fact, invariably he was, and then Joe behind him, and we came through the White House. And, you know, we've been through five times. Okay, take six. And we came up through the White House. And I thought, I just didn't lift off as much and I didn't brake as much. And I flicked it in. It was a bloody fast corner, you know. And we came out the other side and he was still behind me. Mm-hmm. And we got to the end of the run at the Ford chicane and turned around there. Joe pulled up behind him and Steve leapt out the car and his face was as white as his face mask. He said, "You bloody idiots, why do you take me through there so fast?" I said, "You didn't have to follow him."
Yeah.
You know, he could have backed off. Yeah. And he didn't.
Do you believe the story that during the filming, with obviously there was the Solar Productions 908 with all the camera gear entered in the race, there's a story that during the night he snuck out in the car and did a stint. What do you believe that?
No.
Because we all want it to be true, don't we?
Yeah, I don't think he did. I mean, he would have been, because he wasn't insured. I mean, the people that, it was his money that went into the first half of the film, which he then subsequently lost. I can't believe he was that stupid or anybody around him would let him get in a race car and the French organisers let him get in and put on somebody's helmet and pretend to be a photographer. I just can't see it. I know how desperate he was to race in it. Mm-hmm. And I think he could have been okay in it. Again, I don't know how consistently good he was, but no, I swear he didn't do that.
It's time for a few more questions before we move on to the Hall of Fame. Was that last question better phrased? Was that okay?
Yeah, you're getting better.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the only way is up. Okay, so some from Jens P. He's wow, I'm really looking forward to the next podcast with Derek. So another of your fans here. He wants to know about your time at Broadspeed and what it was like to work with Ralph Broad and the mighty XJC.
Oh, blimey. It just makes me laugh every time I think about it. I mean, it wasn't a laughing matter. But Ralph was such a character. It's so amusing. British team leaders always seem to be characters, even from John Wire throughout my career. They had such an amazing aura about them and a humour. And Broadspeed was no exception. You know, I mean, he never stopped smoking cigarettes and he rushed around at 100 miles an hour. He had to be doing everything himself. And we knew he was on lots of pills because he had some illness, which I think was taking lots of pills. Mm. But whatever it was. But he was such a character. Obviously, the car, you know, we all said he over-engineered the car, but we're not engineers, we're drivers. So I'll shut up at that point. But there was so much trick stuff on it. Even to the degree, you know, we didn't, you know, everybody said, but you had power steering. Yeah, we had a power steering pump, but it was pumping oil around the engine because we needed a dry sump and you weren't allowed a dry sump. So, you know, you could hardly turn the bloody steering wheel, but by God, we had good lubrication, you know. But it was, but there was just things that he just did some wonder. I mean, he was bloody clever. Mm-hmm. And I can see really that's where Tom Walkinshaw learned a lot of his tricks, I think, was from Ralph Broad because, you know, Ralph was brilliant. You know, you could write a book about his stuff, and we never got the car quite in time, and so they put us in the Dolomite sprints in a couple of races. But the classic one was really the head of marketing for British Leyland, 3 weeks before the first race at Salzburg, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're in a big hotel in London. This is the car we're going to win." And Salzburg in 3 weeks, and the four drivers went, "Shit, we haven't driven it yet." Seriously, 4 weeks before the race or 3 weeks. So we never, obviously, didn't. We drove up Dolomite Sprints 3 weeks later. And there was a bit of lack of communication between Ralph Broad and the hierarchy. Mm. But he was very clever. You know, there's lots of stuff on the car. And I mean, logically, there's lots of stuff, but there's lots of things that went wrong. But it was like, I really learned about development, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing was the fact you couldn't get the engine to run very well. And when it did run, you got the lubrication right. It meant that then you could do more laps. And then you found that the transmission had a problem. And when you got that right, you found, well, we can even do six laps now without a problem. Right. And then the wheels would fall off. Right. Do you know what I mean? I remember one overtaking me at Wood, coming down the Lavant straight. And I went, this is not good because that must be my wheel because I'm the only one on the track right now. You know? And he went bounding by me, trying to balance it, going to work it on three. And in fact, they took it like a day to find it. It bounced over somewhere over into Mithril Racing, as is today. But we had a lot of laughs, and I can't use half Ralph's language. It was just hilarious. Really? The things he used to say were just...
Is it true that the engine took 6 hours to change on that car? That's sort of a story I've heard.
Oh, I'm sure it did. Well, it weighed about a lot.
Well, I'm told the car weighed 2 tons.
Oh, it was very heavy. It was very difficult to stop. But my God, it was quick sometimes. Mm-hmm. I can tell you the story of it's only really the best race it did, best result it had. We knew we would never win a race against BMWs. It's so obvious. The car was very heavy, as you say, and the light, nimble BMW. So we were going to the Nürburgring, and Andy Rouse was my teammate, and I think it was Tim Schenken and John Fitzpatrick and the other one. I remember saying to Andy, I said, "Look, Andy, we're not going to win here, so let's not go to win. Let's go to finish, because round the Nürburgring, the 167, this car ain't going to land off every jump. Keep together if we go flat out." So he said, "Okay." So we did run second. We still didn't hang about, but we would let the BMW go's Questor or somebody's flying off into the lead. So anyway, at the end of the race, lo and behold, who comes second? We do. Mm. We thought, well, that was actually pretty good. And up comes Eddie Goober, who used to write for Power Slide. Mm. So he comes up in the paddock walking, and we're walking across to the winner's rostrum for our second place. And so Eddie says to me, "That was very good, Derek. Very good drive. Excellent drive from you two guys." I said, "Eddie, but we're only second." He said, "Oh, don't worry. Second's good." I said, "No, but we've got to win. We've got to win, Eddie, somewhere." He said, "Look," he said, "Viva second once, and look where we are now." Anyway,
so it was second twice, actually.
Yeah. So anyway, Yeah. Anyway, it was the one race we were going to win, famous last words, would have been the Tourist Trophy at the end of that year. Mm-hmm. And we were leading, I don't know by much, but we were leading pleasantly, no problems. And it wasn't long from the end, and Andy had a bit of a moment going around Abbey Curve. And then that was it.
Not a technical fault.
Unless he had some wheels fall off. But he didn't blame it on anything. He just said, I think I screwed up.
Right, I think we've got time for one more question before we move on to Hall of Fame and selecting a new list of nominees. I'll take one from Matt. Always a pleasure to listen to you, Derek. I'd like to ask him which drive he turned down or was otherwise engaged for that he wishes he had done. Was that phrased okay?
No, beautifully phrased. No, beautifully phrased. In fact, I was
Matt.
I was trying to find fault with it, but it was not. It's actually... There really wasn't a drive that I turned down at all because
you never turned anything down.
No,
did you?
I didn't, did I? But I must admit, when I had Ferrari Cooper and even Lotus at that point, and then of course at the same time, John Wire wanted me to drive the GT40 at Le Mans when it was in September, and I had the test drive, and I would have driven the 68. I would have driven with Pedro, who went on to win, which could have been my first win, but Ferrari wouldn't accept me leaving the team just to go to race for Ford. I can't think why. So no, there wasn't really. There were missed opportunities. Yes, I mean, I think the most poignant one was the fact that at the end of the 71 season with the 917, obviously it was the end of that era, sadly, and David Yorke was off. He was obviously he wasn't required anymore because he wasn't going to be involved with the Mirage team, and David was going off to Martini to run a Formula One team. And Martini, as you know, sponsored Porsche 917. So we all knew each other. And David said, if I come to run a team for you, Derek Bell will be driving for me, which was really good because he obviously had a bit of confidence in me. So that was going to be the deal. And actually, he went along during that autumn of 19s, whenever it was. During that autumn, yes, right. And he went to Brabham and had a very good relationship with them, and we were going to run two cars. It was going to be me and Carlos Reutemann in a Brabham team, obviously with, I guess, Cosworth engines. And of course, at the same time, Techno came along out of the blue and said, come on, we're going to run a car with a flat 12 engine in it. Can't imagine where that's going to come from. But we've been great in Formula 3 and great in karting and great in Formula 2, and I couldn't disagree with it. And David Yorke said, they've come along and they've talked to the Martini brothers, who are Italian, the Count Rossi, and you know what more would an Italian want than another Italian car to beat Ferrari, which they convinced it would do. And I'm going, oh yeah, I've been around long, but I know that doesn't happen. So that was it, and we were all set up. And eventually, they said, well, okay, it depends on the test. Of course, the test was months late. By then, the Brabham thing had gone out the door, and we go and test, and it ran all day basically, on the Pirelli test track, which meant you couldn't go fast, so they couldn't get any lap times, but it did run all right. And then we didn't race till goodness knows when, like June or July later that year. That was a great disappointment because I would love to have driven for Brabham, you know, with Carlos, who I knew I was the equal of in Formula 2, certainly, and Formula 1 wasn't any different, really. It's another 150, 200 horsepower in those days, and the Brabhams are always great chassis, and it would have been wonderful. But then I got out and went to sports cars, and I've still been racing. So I guess I made the right decision. That worked okay. So there wasn't anything really apart from that disappointment.
Right. Let's turn our attention to the Hall of Fame. Congratulations again on being voted in as the 2016 sports car inductee. Very well deserved.
Thank you very much.
So last year we had a list of 12 names that the public voted on, and the one with the most votes went in. What we want to do is try and give the public a fresh set of names, but there are three names who came very close to Derek in terms of votes.
Not that close, I'm
no,
sure.
No, no, no. It was a couple close, of laps actually. Behind, if I'm honest. Yeah. And those were Redmond, Rodriguez, and Elford. So I propose that they should go back in to be voted on again. They're all worthy candidates, I would say. Disagree, Derek? There's a raised eyebrow there.
No, I totally agree. I mean, I think of poor old Vic. He doesn't get recognised very much.
Do you think he's a great, sort of an underrated an underrated sports car driver?
He is, but he retired. And yes. If he hadn't retired, he would have been great. But he sort of went bang, bang, did a bit of this, did a bit of Formula One, did the wonderful rallying, won the Monte Carlo Grand Prix, Monte Carlo rally, rather, and then one Daytona, both of those in the same year for Porsche. It's absolutely amazing what he did. But then he went and decided he wanted to run his own team. So he sort of shot himself in the foot. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of, he was amazingly fast. Mm-hmm. He was a real competitor. Uh-huh. I mean, I only knew him very briefly, obviously, but it was brief, was in 71. And the one person we had to beat every time was Elford, mm-hmm. or Elford's car. He was outstandingly quick.
He had a lot of experience in the 1917, because he told me this, that he is the only guy to drive every iteration of the car.
Well, he could be, yes. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't dispute that. He was very close to Porsche. He spoke fluent German.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
really?
Well, he does now anyway. Uh-huh. I guess he did then. And they obviously loved him because, you know, he got in there very close to them with the rally projects. Mm-hmm. And because of the rallying, obviously, you spend a lot of time with all these people, whereas as a race driver, you sort of go for the weekend and come away. Nowadays, you sort of might live near the team, but in those days, you just went off, did the race, and came back and did another one somewhere else. I think he is an amazing talent. Having said that, Brian Redman had a much better sports car career.
Yeah.
Forget they both did a bit of Formula One, I think, in the same diabolical car, actually, but...
Well, of course, they both drove Formula Coopers.
Yes, did I say that? Yes. You said that, didn't you? You shouldn't have said that, actually.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, because I didn't say that.
Of course, Redman had his big shunt at Spa.
And Rodriguez drove that car too, you realise.
I wonder whether we're going to have our first pixelated bit on the video so that no one knows who's talking.
That's right.
How would you rate Redman? Because he was a guy who almost didn't pursue the F1
Well, he had a bloody great crash. That was
yes,
but you know Brian. I mean, I haven't totally read his book. I read a lot of it, and it's very, very good. I shouldn't be saying this about him, but he is a great guy. But he sort of seemed to bail out all the time, and so he went off and lived in Africa, South Africa. You know, for various reasons.
Did he
during that period? I can't remember just when he went, because one of the reasons I got the drive at Ferrari. But then that doesn't totally make sense, is the fact he left the team. But I don't think I don't know. He was at Ferrari before me, and then I went there after him. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he drove the 312 2 years later, so he can't have gone far away.
No, quite.
But he did have an accident, didn't he?
Several
big accidents. And obviously then he had the Tagliaferri and the Porsche.
Yes.
So that was the worst. Yeah, so... he had a pretty awful career at that point. And then, of course, he sort of left it and then came back to it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can do that. You know, I think you've got to keep going. And you've got a head of speed. You should keep going for it. But I thought he was amazingly talented. And when I drove against him in America. And he was the king of Formula 5000.
Mm, yes.
And in fact, I replaced him a couple of times in America when he was doing other stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was always with the best teams. He had to be... He was a great talent. Mm-hmm. But we're talking as a sports car driver. We're not talking about what he was like in single-seaters. I mean, without a doubt, if we're talking about a Hall of Fame with just the talent of being a racing driver, Brian would have to be outstanding in that.
Oh, really? Do you feel he was a real natural?
Oh, he was. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, what he did, I mean, he just took off to America. So that must have been 73. Off he goes to America because he realizes sports car racing's changed here. Mm-hmm. Whereas I was only beginning in sports cars, so I could afford to take sit back and just be a test driver with John Wire, for example, and drive other things. No, I think he was... At that era, he was certain, in my opinion, the greatest all-rounder.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Gary, what are your thoughts on Rodriguez?
Well, he's a
worthy candidate for
absolutely. There's a mystique around him that for someone of my age who never saw him race, I don't really understand. So, you know, everyone talks about the BOAC 1000 at Brands Hatch and the amazing drive. Yeah. I mean, what was he like to drive against, and what was he like as a man?
Well, I didn't know I was going to go to sports cars, and I certainly didn't watch the race because I was at Hockenheim.
Yes.
Anyway, I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get to know him till I joined John Wire in 71. And I knew he was outstanding, and as a driver, it was like, God, I've got to be with Rodriguez and Siffert, you know. how the hell am I ever going to go as quick as they do? Mm-hmm. But ultimately one does, rather like the Jackie Ickx scenario. You learn so much from them, and they are such a target to go for all the time. Mm. But I thought he was outstanding. To me, he certainly was the quickest in our team.
Really?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Quicker than Siffert.
Yeah, Joe could do it, but he didn't do it as regularly as Pedro, in my opinion. And maybe Joe might have been a bit harsher on the car. Again, I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. But certainly Pedro was exceptionally good. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, after a couple of races, three races in, Pedro said, when I got pole at Spa, ahead of Pedro, let me say, but I have to say that because nobody else will. 2 seconds it was, actually. Anyway, and it's on the old track. They're talking about Formula One, how they're averaging the speeds this day, and they're talking about it the weekend at Spa, and they're going, I did 164 mile an hour average around the old track.
Yeah.
You know,
Without barriers.
But of course, if they went around there now, the bloody cars would take off the road, but they would go 200 miles an hour average. So I'm not saying, but I mean, that was quite special for us a lot in those days. And afterwards, Pedro said to me, I think it's time you drive with me, Derek.
Oh, really?
It was quite funny as he ate on another one of his hot peppers. but yeah, he was great. Very quiet, easygoing, never said much, just got on with it. Mm-hmm. The only thing I will say, and it's not to his detriment, but you know, you survey drivers, and it was very brief because I wasn't with him that long, because I mean, only with him for about five races, or in the same team. But he had people always used to come and say, God, you should see Pedro overtaking out there. Mm-hmm. And we said, I remember, I was sitting back listening because I was so new to it all. And people were saying, yeah, but he can't do that forever. He's going to hit somebody one day. Somebody's going to shut the door on him. And he just took, I mean, you saw the Donahue car at Daytona that year. It wasn't blue anymore. It was covered in bloody grey racers tape. Mm-hmm. He just kept hitting it, you know. And, you know, Jackie Oliver didn't do that sort of thing. And in many ways, our car didn't get damaged. But Pedro was just went for it. Everything. And we always felt that you can't do that forever. And that's an awful thing to say to a guy who can't defend himself. But he was outrageously good. But I think he couldn't quite control it sometimes. Really? I mean, he and Joe hitting at the bottom of Eau Rouge.
Yeah, that brilliant picture.
Brilliant picture. It was sort of in the... Yeah, it was, yeah. So there you go.
Would you think Siffert should be on our list as a great? You know, you look at his successes at the end of the 60s, 907s, 908.
Yeah, well, he drove a Porsche all through that era.
Yeah,
he was as quick as anybody. Mm. Joe was. And probably quicker than, well, he's certainly quicker than most. But you've got to think there was Siffert and Rodriguez and
Redmond. Elford, yeah.
And Brian too.
Yes.
But I would say that Elford just had something extra.
Really? Yeah. Against
that? I shouldn't say that because I was in it. But you see, Brian had moved on when I got into sports.
Yes.
In a way, although I raced against him in the 312 Ferrari and I was in the Mirage. Mm-hmm. But I thought Pedro and Elford and Siffert sort of would take maybe extra chances, whereas a lot of the other guys didn't.
What was Siffert like as a man as well? He sort of always looked the Swiss gentleman to me in photographs.
He was really charming. Uh-huh. I mean, he was a perfect teammate for me because I got on so well with him, you know. And I used to phone them up, you know, during the week because I get a call from Wow, you come testing at Silverstone tomorrow, and I say, see you at Silverstone tomorrow, then Joe. Oh, I not come there. And I'd say, phone up Pedro, are you coming to... I'm not coming. No, I'm not going testing. They didn't want to drive the 99-17.
Oh, right.
They were just so terrified after what it had been before, which
by
is a bit
reputation.
Naive. Mm-hmm. By reputation, although they had driven it and won the world championship in 70, I suppose. So they knew it was damn good, but it was this funny sort of, yeah, we'll leave it to you and Jackie Oliver to do the testing. We don't want to do that. But as a person, he was great. Great enthusiasm.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And he was, you know, he was a really, really, really nice guy. So a pretty lean year. I lost two teammates.
Sorry, just before we go on. So I think we're all decided that Redmond, Rodriguez and Elford should go back into the pot for now.
Yes.
The ones that we are looking at dropping out and putting in new names, Rondo, Wire, Jean Dubien, Ludwig, Joost, Bonato, McNish and Pescarolo.
Well, Wire. Because I want to hear Derek tell us some stories about John Wire, because again, I'm too young to remember. I never met John Wire. I'm too young. So I just, you know, what was he like to work with? And why was he so good?
Well, I think his experience again. Mm-hmm. And had this dry sense of humour and this sort of... I mean, Frank Garden used to call him Death Ray.
Did he? Right.
Because he used to walk around sort of stooping, walking very... He never looked very well. He was always very pallid.
Really?
Oh, terribly pallid. Didn't say anything to anybody. Walked with his eyes... I remember walking through the Gulf factory at Woking one day in the 917... No, it must have been after that, the Gulf. And I was walking through sort of in jeans and a fancy shirt sort of thing. And he was walking down the other side of the cars. And I went, I didn't quite say, good morning, John. I looked across and he went... Good morning, Belle. A riot of colour again, I see.
He was definitely old
school. No, he was old school. It was just like being at bloody school. And that's why I loved it, because, I mean, it gave me a great... And remember, you know, I was with him with all the guys we've just mentioned, really. And they'd all been through it as well. And he was a headmaster. And you just, you know, you had to be... Oh, not a good time to talk to him today, you know. Best things to leave him out of it. And as I say... Dear old Frank Gardner used to call him Death Ray, because if he gave you the look, you're going, oh shit, I'm going to die later. You're going to have to pixelate this one. But anyway, but he was an amazing character. There weren't that many stories, but I mean, you know, the general way the team was running, you had Grady Davis, who was the vice president of Gulf Oil. He was a racer himself in America. And it was he that somehow had been convinced that Gulf should go into racing. Mm-hmm. And probably he that said, we've got to do this. Either John Wire contacted him or something else, but it went back to the GT40s, remember? And remember, for that, John Wire ran the Aston Martin team.
Yes, of course.
And he had the big fire at Goodwood in the sort of the 9-hour race when, you know, throwing churns of fuel in the middle of the night. Suddenly the car caught a light. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, right.
Oh, major. The whole bloody pits went up. Anyway, up pretty badly anyway. But he was just such... He was the one. I mean, everybody around him had John Horseman underneath, who was a very bright engineer, you know, had gone through the real routine of becoming an engineer. And you had then David York, who was sort of team manager, come, I'll look after the drivers and make sure they're in the right place at the right time. And even when David talked to you, you know, you go, hey, it's David, what is it? Oh, certainly, yeah, whenever you say, you know what I mean? It was like that. Mm. And I always thought all the teams I went to would be like that. I went to Ferrari and I thought it'd be just like that, but it really wasn't at all. And he's like, help yourself. When the car comes in, you may as well jump in, you know. But with JW, it was very, very, sort of very serious, very correct. Uh-huh. And, I mean, their records that they kept were unbelievable. I remember we were testing the Mirage in like 73 or something at Sebring. Bloody thing was awful. I mean, it just was awful. Things just falling. I just wouldn't go anywhere at all fast. I remember they'd all sit around and, how are we going to sort this out, you know, on their third martini? And old Wire would say, Arnold Stafford used to look after that sort of thing. He said, contact Woking back at the factory. He said, go to the records of when we ran the GT40 here in 68. And so, you know, Arnold would go with staff and come back with the something that they had done when we had a similar handling thing, and say, okay, there we are. We'll try that on our Mirage and it would work. Uh-huh. But those sort of, he had the records were always, I mean, everything was done longhand. Mm-hmm. And then when you saw them, like 2 weeks later, it was all, you know, done out by typing. Uh-huh. I mean, most places I went, it was on the back of a cigarette.
Yeah,
back,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
He gave me that amazing sort of guidance, which I say Jackie did, Chris Amon did in many ways. To sort of how you, and I'm totally disorganized myself, so it did help a lot. But they were just so methodical.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're all agreed that Wire should go back into the pot. Yeah. Okay. Well, so I think we should throw in some new names, because obviously we'd like the public to vote on new.
Whilst we're on
people.
Sort of, you know, engineers, people on that side of the pit wall, Norbert Singer, you know, who is a legend, isn't he? You know, a man who, you know, was instrumental in. I think we can say he played a part in all of Porsche's first 16 Le Mans wins, not obviously in the last two, but yeah, he played a part in all of them. And of course, yeah, he was there as a sort of guiding light when you went in, you know, when your career kick-started again in the 80s.
Yeah, no, he was there obviously with the 917.
Do you remember him back from those days
as
well?
Oh yeah, I mean when. I remember vividly. He was in charge of the 9:17 test we did in the April at Le Mans, when I went up. We were walking across the paddock after practice at Le Mans test weekend, and he says, "So what revs are you pulling on the straight?" So I said 8,100, and he said, "That is good, because at 8.2 she blows up." And he went, "Okay." I got the message now, which was Ferrari, it's like take it till you get valve bounce and then shift.
Oh, right, okay.
And then come back from there.
That's right. And so then he got his slide rule out, because we didn't have anything more handy than slide rules then. So he gets it out and he starts to laugh. We're still walking across. I've been driving this thing up and down over 200 miles an hour all bloody day like this. And so Jackie Oliver. And Jackie wasn't with me at this point, so walking across. So he starts to laugh. I said, "What are you laughing about?" He said, "I just calculated your top speed." So he keeps. I said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "I think you better you don't know." So we keep walking, and he says, "I said, look, Siffert, me, and Jackie and Rodriguez have got to drive these cars for 24 hours. We need. It's nice to know how fast you're going." And he said, "Allowing for tire growth, that's 396 kilometers an hour, which is 246."
Blimey!
And taking the kink flat.
Wow.
It's amazing, in a car which didn't have ground effect.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't go that fast with ground effect. That's why we only did 230 odd in the 962s, you see.
What was the 956, the 962? They were just amazing cars, obviously very important in your career. Why were they such good cars? Were they just engineered so well?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, it was because it was a Porsche. Mm-hmm. I honestly have to say it's, and there's nobody that's done so much for endurance racing as Porsche in the last 40 years or something, 30 years. What they have done with what they came in with, and even the Piëch factor of insisting on having a 917 and putting them into the big time. And then, sort of suddenly they're 935s, and then they saw the rules changing, and Norbert probably was something to do with the rule changes. And suddenly they're coming up with this monocoque. And I remember when I actually got the opportunity to Ix and I had won in the 936 in 81, the Jules car. And then I get summoned back to the factory for the Christmas thing, and Helmut Bott says, "Oh, we'd like to talk to you about next year. We're bringing in these Group C cars and the 956. We'd like you to be in one of the cars." I said, "Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much." So I was looking a bit vacant. I said, "What is a Group C car?" So he said, "We're building a monocoque chassis." We have never built a monocoque chassis. He said, "We're also building a horizontally opposed engine." Well, we have that. But nobody has ever put a horizontally opposed engine into a monocoque chassis. And he said, "We have got ground effect as well. And nobody's ever done all those together." And I thought, it looks a bit bleak, this, really. And so he looked at me and said, "But we have never been wrong before."
Right.
So that sums up Porsche and how they go racing. And that was it.
What was Singer like, sort of, because Singer, as well as sort of, he led the design of all the cars.
Yes.
To call him the designer is not quite right.
No.
Because he focused on the aero.
Yes, very much.
And sort of, project managed, if you like. But he was very important at the racetrack as well. Did he basically engineer one of the cars at all the races?
Always, yes, yeah. Always did, yeah.
So whether that was you and Jackie or whoever later.
No, that's right. No, right. He was totally in charge of
really?
That. And oversaw basically both of the cars. And he's a bloke that you could always, even after that was over, I would phone him up about something. He'd tell me the honest truth. Even those flat bottom cars that time.
Yes.
And I went and saw him. I said, "Norbert, my car's shaking and shuddering."
It was a Kramer car.
Kramer car, breaking all the mirrors off. Going down Mulsanne straight, and I can't go flat out. He said, "How thick's the floor?" I said, 12 millimetres. He said, "You need 18.
Oh, right.
And that was for another team.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I was one of his drivers, and they always have a great loyalty. And even if I go to even some work they did on that little red Porsche five, 6 years ago, I went to pay for it. They said, "No, you're part of our family."
Is that right?
Yeah.
Really? Very nice.
Yeah.
So,
and they've always been like that. Sorry, we could talk for
hours. No, not at all. I'm wary of the fact that we have six names in the pot at the moment, and we need to find another six.
But definitely Singer's are very important.
Okay, well, so Singer, I'll put in there at the moment. We can always, if we end up with too many, we can drop a few out.
Should we stay on the Porsche theme as people who Have been important in the history of Porsche Motorsport, not just on the driving side. Al Hulbert Jr. I mean, a guy you had a lot of success with, but his significance in Porsche's history in North America is not just about driving, is it?
No, you're right. The only thing I will say is Al was there for such a brief time, mm-hmm. sadly. You know, it's 5 years. I think the people we're talking, I mean, I'd be very happy for Al to be in it, mm-hmm. because I think he was probably the best all-round driver I ever worked with.
Is that right?
Oh yeah. Because he said he could, he ran the team, he designed his own, you know, sort of modifications for the car. Mm-hmm. He would build them, and the engines were done at Andile. He would team manage, and then he would drive the thing on race day and be very quick, as you know, as quick as I was, and never really put a foot wrong. Mm-hmm. So he was the best all-round person I ever worked with. And I don't think he ever gets enough accolades for what he did. Really. But it was such a short space of time.
But not necessarily, because don't forget that as well as winning IMSA titles in the 80s, he won IMSA titles with Chevrolet in the 70s.
Yes.
So, in terms of Porsche, obviously, he's sort of... You know, his time was cut short, but he had a significant career before then. You know, and he was not really so much within our remit, or maybe on the verges of it. He was a handy Can-Am driver in sort of
it was amazing
Mark II Can-Am
and IndyCar. You know what I mean? He was so versatile. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, you've got a heck of a difficult task. You see, if you really go back, John Wire did a hell of a lot because of Aston Martin. For the GT40, and then of course with the with the 917, and then the Mirage. I mean, he was out there for 10 or 12 years, wasn't he?
Just going back to Hulbert, throw in some stats: 49 IMSA wins during his career, which is the original IMSA.
Yes.
That's a record.
Yeah, sure it is.
So
it's amazing, and take him as an all rounder.
I'm going to throw two names in who I think are both very worthy to be put into the pot. Pirro and Phil Hill, who I think, Pirro, five-time Le Mans winner. Anyone who can do that, Derek, has obviously done a reasonably good job.
Beena as well, given that they... So it's talking that, the five wins club, we should throw Frank Beena in there as well.
Yes, right? Pirro and Beena. And Phil Hill, because he... I mean, he won Sebring lots. He won loads of sports car races, and he was just, I think, an extremely quick, safe driver. Would you agree with Pirro?
You can't dispute it. I mean, all the people you're talking about are so good. I mean, what a group!
Yeah,
I mean, that's why you're doing what you're doing. You have 12 people. Mm. It's difficult to find the 12 or to select the 12 out of the 25 you've probably got.
I guess
Phil Hill, I think. I don't know enough about his history, although I've got his book, or one of his books.
Haven't you got a book out, Derek? It's available all good bookstores.
From the remainder bin.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. I think Phil was so versatile and drove so many things. And when you think he was one of the few drivers that came to Europe in that period from America, and no doubt if you check into the races he did in sort of remote places like. The Bahamas, Speed Week and all those sort of things that those drivers went and did. I mean, he's certainly really up there. I think you should look at a bit more of their history.
Did you ever race against Phil Hill? Because I'm just thinking your careers probably just abutted rather than overlapped.
No, I don't think so, no.
No.
A couple of other names from the motorsport office, Beloff and Bob Wallach.
Yeah,
they were both thrown into the pot. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, they're both. I mean, again, outstanding. They do deserve accolades. Of course, they do. Stefan wasn't there long enough, but then,
he made such an impression in such a short space of time.
So brightly,
it did, didn't it? Yes, he was outstanding. Mm. I mean, he was. I mean, he was no doubt the quickest of all the drivers I ever raced with. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Did they deliberately pair him with you to sort of? Almost to sort of tutor, they wanted you, the sort of the old hand, as it were, to sort of tutor him.
Thanks, Gary. You're getting up there too, don't worry. But
perhaps calm him down, even.
Yeah, well, they did the same with Stucky. I mean, Stucky told me 3 or 4 years ago, he said, oh, there's another one, for example. But
he's on the list,
of course.
I mean,
that's
you know,
the pot.
Stuckey was really, Hans was, I would say Hans was just as quick as Beloff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so. Just that we saw him later on in his career, rather yes. probably like me. I mean, in some ways, but no, I think Stuck was he kept going a lot longer.
On Beloff, I mean, obviously the famous 6:11 lap yes. of the Nordschleife, and then the accident yes. that he had when he wrote the car off. That tell us the story about you going onto the pit wall and saying that, you know, maybe they needed to rein him back. They didn't. Yeah. He set the record,
and then never came round.
Yes.
yeah. No. I'd never won at the Nürburgring. And it was, what, you know, you can imagine there's certain racetracks, and you say, Paul didn't win there, but you won elsewhere. I know that. But, you know, there's always, you go, I've got to win this damn thing. And I'd had Formula 2 records there, lap records, but never won. And it even did two Grand Prix there and that sort of thing, and sports car races leading until the last lap, but never won. And we were well in the lead. And I thought I'd kept my end up, I guess, because we hadn't lost the lead when I got in. And I still did some of my quickest laps, but they weren't quite as quick as his. And you know, I went up to Helmut Bott, who was in the pits, and I said, it's like 40 minutes to go. We'd be quite a good idea. I mean, shall we? Why don't you tell him to hold or take it easy or whatever you want? Okay.
Stop doing what he's doing.
yeah. And he just looked at me and said, isn't he brilliant? And then turned around to the team, and I went, and he didn't come around again. Well, soon after that. So, you know, He was brilliant overall. I'm not going into his life or the fact he didn't end up with a life. He was astonishingly good. I was always just disappointed, and it's in his book when I was interviewed. I don't think he was never managed properly.
Oh, really?
I felt don't you think the fact that they let him drive? I mean, anything else, you get to, hey, calm down a bit, old son. What have they done with Verstappen? Everybody's telling you better calm down a bit. Mm-hmm. But they never told Stefan.
Do you think there was no one there?
No, there was no one there. And I was always a bit disappointed in the people around him, remembering he was in a Formula One team as well.
Yes.
That somebody didn't say, actually, this kid's bloody brilliant, but we really need to sort of make him realise how good he is.
You would have thought Ken Tyrrell would have
done
that.
Well, I didn't mention his name. And when he went to Formula One, I thought, thank goodness for that. You know, I think Ken will rein him in the way he sort of calmed Francois Sever probably and whatever, even with Jackie Stewart. And I just thought when he went... you know, to Tyrrell, he would make a change. But maybe he was unchangeable, and maybe if Ken, bless him, could talk, he would say, I did try, Derek, but he didn't respond.
So,
you see, he didn't know his limits. There have been lots of drivers over the years that didn't know their limits, and not many of them are here.
We are very sadly out of time, but what I want to, I'd run through the names with you of what we've got. Being the 2016 winner, I think you should have final say on this, Derek. And some feedback from you, Gary, as well would be great. So Redmond, Rodriguez and Alford.
Yes.
Happy with those three. Pirro, Bieler, Phil Hill. Yeah. Happy with those three. Siffert, Wire and Singer.
Yes.
How many have we got, actually?
We've got 12 here. Okay. But I'm going to ask whether the likes of Barnato should be dropped. But is he a better name than any of these? Because he did so much.
Well, obviously a man who has an unbeaten record at Le Mans. Entered three times, wins three times. Important in the history of Bentley, you know, saved the company, owned it. But then I would say Pescarolo, you know, an amazing career as a driver.
And what about Yerst?
And, you know,
if you're getting into team owners.
We could argue them all, although maybe Derek won't argue for Ludwig, but there you go. And Jean de Bion, you know.
Yeah, Jean de Bion,
who
goodness.
Who was the sort of, you know, the icks of his era.
Okay, so,
am I allowed to throw any other names into the hat? For next year?
Okay, well, we've got the 12 at the moment. Redmond, Rodriguez, Alford, Pirro, Bieler, Phil Hill, Siffert, Wyatt, Singer, Al Holbert, Beloff, Hans Stuck. So if we're going to put any more in there, we've got to be willing to drop one of those. And are you willing to say any of those aren't, or not worthy, because they can always come back in next year, but for this year, would you be happy to lose any of those off the list? Because I think there is an argument, a very valid argument for all of those people. And likewise, there are very valid arguments for a lot of the people we're leaving off. I mean, Alan McNish, for example.
And a few we haven't talked about, who I'm going to say...
right, well, throw
well, Wallach, we didn't talk... We just touched on him very briefly. I'd like to put in, you know, if we have Pirro and Bieler, why not Capello? He's the overlooked sort of driver of that generation of Audi driver, you know, because perhaps he was always in the shadow of... TK and McNish, we forget that he is a three-time Le Mans winner. Holds the record for the most Sebring wins, doesn't he, I think? I might have got that wrong.
Certainly not me, anyway.
well, then, and that brings us back to Andy Wallace, who, because I wanted to talk about the Maurice Cherazzi Auto Toy Star year when perhaps you did win Sebring, and then you would have joined the Triple Crown Club. But anyway,
I'm not saying anymore. We haven't got time.
No,
but you're totally right. We would have done.
Well, I would say
what a horrible little car it was.
Yeah, I'm going to say for me, Siffert yes, Wire yes, Singer 100%, Holbert, Beloff, Stuck. Then we all seem agreed there, and then I think we've got the sort of Pirro's, Bieler's, Hills, Wallach's, Wallace's, and Capello sort of fighting it out for the remaining slot. So how's my maths? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So I reckon we've got, yeah, a few
so
others.
We've got to decide. We've got to pick three from these names.
I would love
Pirro,
to
Bieler,
see
Phil Hill, Wallach, Capello,
Bob Wallach in it, because for me, he was a hero. You know, he didn't win Le Mans. Sterling Moss didn't win the World Championship. Yeah. It doesn't affect.
No, Hall of Fame is not about stats. It's about
I think he's a legend, and you know, the length of his career and the achievements he was still racking up in his 50s.
Yeah, he was an Iron Man. He was unbelievably strong. I mean, I said, how the hell do you do it, Bob? He just kept going under all these conditions, you know.
And is it true, back in the sort of 80s, he was a chain smoker? Is that right? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I don't remember it, but I know he did smoke. Yeah, yeah. Well, but what about Bieler, for God's sake?
Well, so yeah, quite.
Okay, so let's put a tick next to Wallach. We've got two more to choose from that list of six names. Derek, why don't you pick one to go in from that list of six? Call the casting vote, and then we'll
out of this six, you mean?
Yeah. So Wallach's already in. Sorry, out of this five, sorry, I can't even count.
Yeah.
Then on your head be it, and it's not responsible.
I think Phil Hill. I'd say Phil Hill and Wallace.
Phil Hill and Wallace out of those. So we're leaving only out because Pirro,
I think
time Le Mans
yeah, but there's I think there's
that,
plenty of time. Yeah, but he can come back next year.
Yeah, no, he can absolutely.
Pirro. Let's
bring him in. You know, I mean, I had to wait a bloody long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I remember Jackie got in 10 years ago.
Well, to be fair, it hasn't been going 10 years. It's only been going for a few years.
I went to some big place in the middle of London. I went in there.
Yeah.
Probably 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It was very impressive.
I've been pushing every year, Derek, to get you into the Hall of Fame.
You're very kind. Yeah. No, but I didn't expect to be. No, but you see, I didn't expect it. To me, it should have been there before me. And I, you know, I haven't followed it enough to who got it in the other years. Obviously, Fangio should have got it. Sterling should. I mean, the people you got that have got it ahead of me were... I would never attempt to be in that.
To be fair, so last year was the first time we actually split it into categories.
Yes.
And so, you know, sports cars have their own category US racing, Formula One, motorbikes. And this is the second year of it, which I think is great because it means that, you know, some of these names we wouldn't be discussing if you were only allowed to induct four people from the world of motor racing.
Yes.
But I think it's really good that we can throw these into the pot. Yeah. So,
there's so many, that's the problem.
I think...
Could we just finish with... Now Andy Wallace has made the cut. Could we finish with an Andy Wallace story? We've got to tell us a story about McLaren, Dave Price Racing, Harrods, 1995, the near miss at Le Mans with Justin.
We haven't got time for that. Really.
Yeah, we do.
Just a quick story.
Well, you should have come along to the Brooklands last Saturday night.
Okay.
We had a get together with Gordon Murray and Andy and Dave Price.
Okay.
And who else was there by me? And Dave Price, I said, yeah, who else was it? Anyway, Justin couldn't make it, but he did. He sent across a piece from America with he and Jay Leno in Jay Leno's garage.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
It's a great piece. Uh-huh. And in the background, they had the McLaren. He's got on the wall at Jay's place, and I've been there three times now. but it's bloody great wall. And you walk in, and there is the Harrods car and the UNO Clinic car side by side going down the Moulsard Straight. And underneath it, but it's big. It's just the size of a house. And I walked in, I went, oh, so you do like in big time racing then, Jay? Yeah. And it's still there. And in front of you, he had three more McLarens now. Justin did it in front with Jay just chatting. It was really good. They brought that into the evening show. No, it's really too long a story. And, you know, having been at the weekend with everybody, I'm totally confused as to what really happened. You know, I know that we finished third, but
It was the clutch release bearing.
It was and it wasn't. It was I saw that we always learned, but it was more than that to it. Basically, what happened, what I understood from what took place, unbeknown to us, anybody that was there the other night, the McLaren did a test with the UNO Clinic car, a 24-hour test at Paul Ricard.
Yeah, that wasn't secret.
Well, none of the people said they knew about it. I certainly didn't, but then I was driving everywhere else. But the McLaren, these guys, our team, didn't know about it. And so when they came, and I'm sure somebody did, but whatever, the suggestion was that the clutch release bearing that had been quitting in most of the short distance races, and hence we all thought we wouldn't finish do more than 6 hours, it was recommended that they should use the standard. This is Gordon Murray speaking the other night. They recommended they should use the standard slave cylinder and clutch system that was on the road car, because that's what they'd learned doing that. And somebody in our team supposedly said, no, don't believe in that. Uh-huh. Nobody's tested that enough. We don't believe it.
Right.
So we didn't run it. And Gordon Murray said, asked the other, he said, without a doubt, you were going to win that race.
That's not the story I've heard from within DPR, but...
That's why I was with DPR, but you weren't with Gordon Murray the other night, who was a mastermind of the car.
Yes.
And he said he knew what took place, and he was most adamant that it was what I just told you.
This doesn't quite correspond with what someone else has told me from within, the guy who engineered the McLaren EVA, so... So I think
sounds like another podcast.
This is a podcast.
The whole podcast.
Yeah. If you got that lot in, you'd end up not talking. We all did go and have dinner afterwards. He obviously wasn't. I mean, Gordon Murray is such an amazing man. But there was also other innuendo in there. The fact that there was a factory car in it, and they say there wasn't, and we all know it was.
Yes.
I don't say it was official factory, but the fact was that car had never appeared until that guy came in from Japan and said, "I've got the money. Yeah. Let's run a car."
The factory owned it. The factory put the team together. Factory employed the drivers. I make that a factory car, don't you?
I'm not saying a word because I thought the same.
Because the last time you did, Ron Dennis shouted at you.
So there you go.
Yeah. Gordon Murray always said that one of his great regrets is not driving that car on the roads to Le Mans and back again after the race.
Yeah, he said that this week too. That was the dream, to drive one of them on the road, yes. And it was, because I've driven the Harrods car around France.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because it's Dave Clark's got it on plates at the moment, hasn't he?
Yes, oh yeah. No, he drives it, I think, quite a bit,
really?
Even at 25 million. But he, probably not in London, but so I know he did a rally, a fabulous rally, British car rally from Louis Vuitton in London down to Paris and one weekend, one spring or something. And Gordon was in his McLaren, and there were three or four, and Nick Mason was in his. And various other cars, and I was in a Nick Mason 3.8 Jag, and Dave said, you should drive the McLaren, Dave. How many people have actually raced in them?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And then driven it through France. So I did, and it was just fantastic. Absolutely.
Here's a story. Can I get one last story?
Yeah, go on.
People say about the top speed of the McLaren in 1995, but it wasn't the quickest the McLaren went around Le Mans that year, because the race car had a rear wing and a restrictor. So that actually made it slower in a straight line than a road car. JJ Leto drove to a restaurant in, I think, Ray Belm's road car, and apparently went faster than he did in the race car on the road.
Wow.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Yeah. I'd never heard that one either. Yeah. Anyway.
Derek, it's been an absolutely fantastic hour and 20 minutes, as it always is with you. So many stories, and I'm sorry, we always seem to sort of scratch the surface, but I think we've got a few good ones in there. I hope you all enjoyed listening, and I'm very glad we have 12 names for the public to vote on. I know we will have missed people out, but there's always more years, and we will get them in then. Derek, thank you so much for having us in your beautiful house, and Gary, thank you so much for joining us and helping us out on the nominations.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll see you next month for another Hall of Fame podcast. Bye bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.